Welcome to the Two Daft Yanks Podcast, the show that brings you tidbits from all aspects of the soccer world. Sometimes serious, sometimes zany, always opinionated. Now, here are your hosts, Chad Smith and Corey Chatelain.
This is the Two Daft Yanks Podcast. Greetings to you wherever you may be. I am your host, Chad Smith, and I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Corey Chatelain.
Yeah, this week we're bringing the passion. Hashtag P-A-S-S-H-U-N. Passion. It was everywhere this weekend.
And everywhere? What do you mean everywhere?
Oh, well, you know, Stevie G crying after the win because, you know, apparently they clinched the league or something. Passion in the cups yesterday. You know, Arsenal celebrating like they were like they had won the final. Sheffield United and Hull. Passion all over the place, putting in a great FA Cup semifinal match. Arya Stark last week showing passion, you know, revenging her lost friends. It was great, just a passion everywhere. Ray Hudson, Diego Costa almost breaking or might be breaking his leg, scoring a goal to secure a win. There was just passion everywhere.
All right, well, we'll try to make this a passionate podcast for everybody out there. And the rundown this week is really simple. This is our FA Cup semifinal review show. Yeah. Now, a lot of stuff has happened this week. We had, you know, the Champions League where Chelsea squeaked on by. You got Barcelona getting eliminated, right? You had some league matches. We talked about Liverpool and Man City. But we, the Two Daft Yanks, are going to put the action, our words into action. We say we care about the FA Cup, and we do. So this whole episode of the podcast is going to be dedicated to the two FA Cup matches and everything related to them. So are you up for that, Corey?
Hell yeah.
All right, FA Cup!
Although, one quick aside before we start, don't forget Brave Mighty United getting eliminated in the Champions League too, despite a brave, courageous loss performance or whatever. So, anyway.
Sorry, David Moyes.
Yeah, Moyes in forever.
All right, so the FA Cup is now down to just two clubs. It started with, what, over 700?
Yeah, what, I think they said 773 or something, I think was
some big number. Yeah. And now we're down to the final two. So we will break down here, and we will start with the actions of Saturday, which happened first, and that was Arsenal 1 and Wigan 1, but Arsenal advanced 4-2 on the penalty kicks.
Yeah, well, did we win? Because it was one of those weekends where if you read the media, it's if we were allowed to advance, apparently we stole the match some kind of way or something.
Okay, let's check the bitterness at the door here for a second.
Okay.
Okay, please, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it, and I'm sure the listeners will appreciate it. Corey's going to have a rant here soon, folks, so let's just get into this first. Let's talk about the match.
All right.
It was an interesting match, and my first question to you was, were you surprised with Wenger's initial lineup, having Giroud, Chesney, and even Gibbs all on the bench in such an important match?
Well, the Fabianski over Chesney, he said in his press conference on Friday, Friday morning, sorry, that the decision to start Fabianski was made a long time ago. And I kind of have a sneaking suspicion Fabianski's going to play the final too, just because that's, you know, you know, he had just decided to play Fabianski in the cups, regardless of him leaving. Gibbs was going to be a game time decision with the ankle injury anyway. So I think he went with Monreal just because Monreal was healthier and didn't want to risk Gibbs for a full 90 minutes or longer. Now, the Giroud one, I was a little bit surprised, but at the same time, one of the reasons why I do like Wenger so much is that he's not, you know, he's not averse to start, you know, taking those kind of, in this case, a pretty big risk and starting Sanogo. But at the same time, as much as some of the people, like on Fox, were making a big deal about how, or trying to make a big deal about what a risk it was to start in an FA Cup semifinal, you know, Sanogo had already started against Bayern in Munich, so Wigan in Wembley, is that really much more of a bigger task than, you know, starting against what's perceived as, or, you know, what's everybody perceives as the best team in Europe? So, like I said, I didn't really think they were actually that big of a risk. So,
okay, and that's a fair point. So you're telling me that Fabianski has started pretty much every FA Cup game this season?
Yeah, he's played in all the cups.
So that's just Wenger's rotation policy this season.
So far to this point, yeah, and that's been one of the ongoing questions the last couple weeks is, since Fabianski's pretty much made up his mind to leave, if he starts the final, what does that do to Chesney's confidence going forward? If Arsenal wins, you know, if Arsenal wins the final, Fabianski gets the medal, and, you know, Chesney doesn't get to play, but he's your number one, you know, your long-term number one. What does that do for his confidence? So that'll be interesting to see, you know, what decision is made, you know, come May 17th.
And you have, I mean, these are just, I think these are innocent comments, but you have reports in the media at least suggested that Cazorla was saying that he wanted Casillas to come to Arsenal.
Yeah, and there was a little bit more than just your normal rumor smoke during the week about Casillas.
Uh-huh. And then you had earlier in the year, I mean, this would never happen because Levy will never sell a player to Arsenal, but one of the, I forget which French, one of the, maybe it was even a French player, but
yeah,
one of
Giroud.
The, oh, Giroud was talking about how he would like to bring Loris to Arsenal, too. So Wojo can't be too happy.
No, but at the same time, I think it would be a move, you know, if Wenger stays, because that's another question that's seemed to be getting bigger and bigger on the horizon as time goes by, because Wenger has never really let his contract run down this long, you know, whether he stays or not. But if he does and does try to bring in somebody like Casillas, you know, Chesney is young enough that I think he could still, if need be, still deal with a year or two of mentoring or rotation, I guess might be a better word. But if nothing else, you bring in somebody like Casillas that's got a world of experience. If nothing else, it'll keep Chesney on his toes.
Okay. So that's good. So we kind of went down a side road there, but
yeah,
so. We'll get back on track with the match.
Yeah.
And I want to say it in the even in the for the majority of the first half and for the first third of the second half, Arsenal seemed very tentative to me, and they were just happy to soak up the pressure and let Wigan have most of the possession, and they didn't really get going until the last 10 or 15 minutes of the match. Do you think that was by design?
Yeah.
Or were the announcers saying that they were saying nobody from Arsenal was really stepping up to try to win back the ball in midfield?
Yeah, well, for the overall tactics, I do think the tactics were to go and keep it tighter than usual and not push as forward as much as we normally like. Now, part of that, although I will say I don't think it was supposed to be to the extent of leaving it that late in the match to start pressing forward, because I forget when he went off, but yeah, once Wigan basically took McManaman off and they basically decided to try and hold the 1-0, that's definitely when, you know, when we started to to start attacking more and more and start trying to press forward more.
Mm-hmm. And that is my exact next point in my talking points, anyway, is I wrote down here is the match changed when Wigan did sub off McManaman. And so let's just get into this, I guess, this tactical, philosophical decision. Did they do the right thing? Now, granted, their legs in the midfield were looking heavy, but taking off your most attacking player, it kind of, you see it a lot where teams do that and it backfires on you. As in any sport goes, as the old saying says, the best defense is a good attack.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think in Wigan's case, and more specifically Uwe Rosler, what the mindset was we have the 1-0. Yeah, McManaman's been the most dangerous player, but it'll probably be better to try and hold the 1-0 lead because of Arsenal's recent, you know, whatever you want to call it, mental fragility, or you know how their anxiety gets the best of them, and they press, and then since we're leading, they're going to press more, and we'll just try to hit them on the break. Because another thing was pretty evident that once McManaman went off, Marc-Antoine Fortuné basically tried to play for free kicks every time he got the ball high up the field.
Mm-hmm. Now, that is an interesting point you make about Uwe Rosler. Being German, the Germans are really big into psychology. So I bet that's exactly what he was thinking with that substitution.
Yeah, and like anything, it's a calculated risk, and with any risk, there's always, you know, the risk. You know, sometimes it's not the real life tactics and trying to implement those even with a lead. You know, sometimes those aren't as straight as forward as things like Football Manager, or you know, maybe in a league where your opponents are you know, you're more familiar with your direct league opponents, so there's a little more comfort in trying to implement those tactics. Which again, that's one of the things why I personally like the Cup so much, and why more than any other sport. Although I do think it's kind of funny that a lot of people do kind of automatically tend to just take the class or the quality argument that, oh, well, you should be beating a lower division side when, you know, in a one-off match. That's one of the things to me that's so fascinating about the Cups, is that, you know, sometimes the unfamiliarity with each other, even though there's a gulf in class or a perceived gulf in class, that unfamiliarity with players and tactics sometimes leads to, you know, a lot of upsets or just, you know, just interesting tactical battles.
Mm-hmm. So in this match, as we all know, Jordi Gomez scored in the 63rd minute on a penalty, and it was a dead-on penalty with it wasn't a cheap tackle by Mertesacker. He was legitimately trying to win the ball. He just mistimed it.
Yeah, he was definitely off the ball, yeah.
Yeah. But he redeemed himself in the 82nd minute, scoring on a header himself. And at that point in the match, I think pretty much everybody thought Arsenal would be nailed on to if they didn't score, you know, the winner in the rest of regulation, that they would definitely score again in extra time. Was that your feeling as well?
Yeah, it definitely had that feel of a smash and grab, especially when Ox hit his shot. I thought that was in. It was definitely one of those that, even without seeing, or I mean, obviously I was watching and seeing where it was going, but as soon as he hit it, without actually kind of seeing where it was going, without actually kind of, you know, that without that actually processing, if that makes sense, I had instinctively kind of jumped out of my seat because it just felt like it was going to go in when it left his foot. And, you know, obviously it smacked the bar and bounced out. But yeah, it definitely had the feel of a smash and grab. Or if it had gone to extra time, or, you know, if it was going to extra time, it had that feeling of we could probably snatch an early goal in the first extra time period, which we almost did.
Mm-hmm. So Wigan did a good job to hold on, I believe, and get the kicks. And let's talk about this penalty kick situation.
All right.
The announcers, the commentators on our feed here at Fox, and I forget who they were already, which is good.
Tyler and Matt Jackson, I believe.
Oh, was it, Martin? I don't even remember. Because I've watched so much soccer this weekend, I can't remember. But they were making the point that the pressure would be on Arsenal, and that would be an advantage for Wigan. But I'll see what you think about this, but in my mind, I think it's the exact opposite, because obviously Arsenal have better players who are more technically gifted. And so in a penalty kick situation against Arsenal versus Wigan, from just a pure skill standpoint, I think the technical advantage that Arsenal has outweighs any psychological advantage Wigan may have in that situation. What do you think about that?
Yeah, see, I don't know, because that's penalties to a man. All the professionals and coaches generally say that penalties in that situation are much more psychological, or much more of a concentration or a trying to overcome mental fatigue issue than anything else. But to me, that was one of the things that was one of the interesting points of the match all day long, was that depending on whether or not, or how much credence you put into the whole mental state of Arsenal or Wigan, who was the actual favorite, or who were the underdogs, or who the pressure was actually on. Because, obviously Wigan's going to play the underdog role strictly because they're a championship side going up versus an EPL side. But, they beat Manchester City 2 years in a row. They're obviously only one of four teams left in the tournament, as of Saturday. They're the reigning holders. So I don't know. I just thought it was kind of interesting to where, even though they're the smaller club, they're the reigning champs, they're playing better, but yet all of the pressure is somehow on Arsenal. Now, like I said, maybe that's just, a bit of the rope-a-dope on Rosler's part to try and get Wigan to play, to perform well. But like I said, I just thought some of that was interesting, because again, it's a semifinal. I think I thought there was a lot of pressure on either side. So.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point that you make there. These things are all debatable, and that's what makes watching these events even better, is because you could get 10 different people to watch the match, and you very well could have 10 different opinions on what you and I are talking about here today. But when it comes down to me, this is all you really needed to know, that Wigan, when they needed their first penalty kick, they sent out Gary Caldwell out there, who hasn't kicked a ball in a competitive match in almost a year. So I don't see...
I think he's like a club captain or something.
Yeah, I understand that.
A vice captain or something.
Yeah, I understand that he fulfills that role. But obviously, when you trot him out there to take your first kick, and then Arsenal has someone of the quality of Mikel Arteta, and then Jack Collison has taken Wigan's second kick, and Arsenal have Kallstrom. So you got two internationals against two, English grinded out, blood and guts and passion type of guys.
Right.
That's a big mismatch.
Yeah, no, and I was definitely pleased that Arteta took our first penalty kick, because that's definitely a I know we joke about Football Manager on here a lot, but that's definitely one of my theories on penalty kicks, is that 20 years ago or so, one of the theories used to be kind of that you put your best penalty kick taker around third or fourth. And that, because that's about the time you're probably going to, you have a good chance to actually win the match. But I'm a proponent, especially in this day and age where there is so much pressure on everybody, and every every thought is instantly, you know, translated onto Twitter to billions of people. I'm a big proponent of having your main penalty takers go first and second to get on the board, especially if you go first, which we didn't. But you know, if we had gone first, like I said, I'm a huge proponent of inverting your order and having your best penalty takers go first to give yourself a better chance to get on the board and kind of put more pressure, you know, on the other team. So I was definitely pleased that Arteta took our first penalty kick.
Mm-hmm. And let's close out our talk on some of this match-related stuff.
All right.
Positively, and then we could let you go on your rant. But my first question is, and obviously Wigan were in the Premier League last year, so everybody's got to see this guy quite a bit. And I think he had a pretty good game yesterday. You could tell he's a quality player. So what do you think about Jordi Gomez? Do you think that overall he is a prem quality player and that he could be on the move if Wigan so chooses to sell him in the near future?
Yeah, I think from what I've seen of Gomez over the years, he's certainly a good player. I guess the best way to describe Gomez or players like Gomez is that they're never really going to light the world on fire or, you know, be mistaken for the best midfielder in the league. But at the same time, he's the kind of player that I think, how do I want to say this? He could probably make the jump into a good team, or you know, the kind of player that probably could play to the level of the players around him, if that makes sense. So I think he could make the jump, you know, to a bigger side, you know, maybe even somebody like Spurs or maybe even somebody like Manchester United. But at the same time, when I say that, I don't necessarily mean as like an everyday starter, but, you know, like a rotational kind of guy, but, you know, a rotational guy that's got a little bit of quality to him, not somebody that's just kind of filling out the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that Everton, with Martinez being familiar with him, didn't go after him. And maybe that's something they'll do in the summer.
Yeah, because like I said, you can definitely tell he's got a little bit of quality to him. And like I said, I just, from what I've seen of him over the years, like I said, he's not going to be anybody that's ever going to be mistaken for a world-class midfielder, but at the same time, he can be pretty, you know, serviceable.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me mention two negatives here.
Okay.
And this is not really related to the game. This is related to, this is going to be some more Fox Sports bashing, which we love to do here.
Yes.
Oh my goodness, Fox Sports. So why does Fox Sports, why? For the love of God, you people at Fox Sports, you executives, why do you spend money to gain broadcast rights to the FA Cup and then you put it on Fox Sports 2, which is a channel most people don't get, and B, if they do get it, they don't get it in HD. That's complaint number one. Now, I have the logical reason is, and they've done this with other events, I think they're putting these important things on Fox Sports 2, so people will call their cable companies complaining, why don't you have Fox Sports 2?
Right. Yeah,
but still, there was nothing on Fox Sports 1. I think it was like preseason. It was like the Yankees and the Red Sox, so I understand that. But still, on the regional Fox channels, it was like motorcycle racing, poker.
On Big East baseball or something.
Yeah, on main Fox, it was infomercial. So I don't understand. If you're committed to soccer like you say you are, well, then prove it. Put the game on a channel people could watch. I mean, Arsenal has a big following in the United States. I don't understand it.
Well, but I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it has more to do with subtly trying to get Fox Sports 2 more widely distributed so they can get more distribution and advertising money, and then B, start charging more to actually show Fox Sports 2. So, yeah. Like I said, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think that's exactly why they moved it to Fox Sports 2.
It's a pure business decision, which is sad.
Yeah.
But hey, that, you know, that Big East baseball. That's
hard. It was all of about 104 people in attendance when they cut to it after the match.
Oh, see, I didn't even see it. I turned it off by then.
Yeah.
All right, and then the last thing is, so it sounds like you actually did get the Fox Sports feed. Or do you have Fox Sports 2 in Alaska?
No, I don't personally, because I get my TV through my landlord, and she has satellite. But my other Arsenal buddy up here, I watch it at his house, and he has cable.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think he bought the extended sports package or whatever it's called, because I'm pretty sure they don't. I'm pretty sure it's not offered on the basic cable package up here. But yeah, so it was actually on. We actually did get it, though.
Okay. So then you got to see just the absolute travesty, and why Fox Sports continues to do this is bringing on Piers Morgan to analyze Arsenal matches is the most cringiest thing ever.
Yeah, and it's that and that's another case of Fox. I don't think he owns them anymore, but the whole. Fox News and Fox Sports in general has always been kind of a, you know, they've taken the programming mindset of basically just rabble rousing and let's put it this way, they were trolling before trolling became popular.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, definitely.
Yeah, so having, or you know, it's what I call the Rupert Murdochification of TV. Where it's just about, you know, riling people up and pissing people off. Yeah, so that's exactly why they have Piers Morgan on there, because he's, quote-unquote, you know, a TV personality and an Arsenal fan, because he's actually an Arsenal shareholder. But the reason why they pick him is because he's so unpopular with other Arsenal fans that he's just there basically to, you know, to be a self-parodying Arsenal troll, basically.
The guy's a complete clown. I mean, he's calling for Wenger sacking. Like, that's basically the only thing he says. Oh, we're terrible. Wenger needs to be go. And I hope Wenger does go, so then we get to hear Piers Morgan complain about, oh, the new manager stinks. Bring Wenger back.
Well, yeah, and Morgan's one of those guys that's big on the Jurgen Klopp train, or just assumes that just because Wenger leaves that somebody like Klopp is automatically going to want to come to Arsenal. So like I said, he's basically a fan, like the worst part of a fanboy, which is saying a lot, just embodied into a person that gets to have a bully pulpit on TV because of his, you know, because of his, well, now his former job at CNN. You know, and former news editor at News of the World, which it always makes me laugh about Piers Morgan is a lot of people over here don't know, and especially the people that used to watch him on, well, all six people that used to watch him on CNN don't know why he was in the United States to begin with, because he's over here trying to hide from having to testify, or was over here trying to hide from testifying in that. That phone hacking case from the News of the World magazine or newspaper.
Yeah, he was responsible for hacking into phones of dead people.
Yeah, so like I said,
that's pretty awesome, Piers Morgan.
Yes, which, you know, and of course it's allegedly, but you know, he was the editor of that department, you know, where reporters were doing that, and I'm pretty sure those reporters didn't think of that on their own, and if they did, you know, if he was a news editor that was worth a damn, I'm pretty sure he asked where that information came from, and when they told him, you know, he either didn't care or, like I said, he was the one actually ordering it. But so again, that's an aside that doesn't really matter to soccer, but like I said, that's what makes me laugh about Piers Morgan, is that he's basically, you know, a shady pain in the ass that, you know, that gets a free pass because, you know, he's a TV personality over here, or mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I know you've been sacked from CNN, Piers, and this goes to Fox Sports. If you are going to be dumb enough or daft enough, let's say this is daft. This is dafter than you and I combined times affinity. If I see Piers Morgan on my television on FA Cup Sunday, at the final, I'm going to the illegal pirated stream because I will not put up with it. All right. That's the final word for me on that.
Yeah, no, and I obviously being an Arsenal supporter and one that's not in the Wenger out brigade, yeah, I can't stand Piers Morgan, so.
All right, I'll let you have your brief moment here if you want to talk about, if you want to get something off your chest.
All right, yeah, because we can actually use it to segue into the brilliant pulsating other semifinal that was today. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just the whole this whole concept that seemed to kind of flourish yesterday on Twitter after the match, and I've seen it before in a different avenue. There's apparently this new, like, and I don't know who's on it exactly. I don't know if it's papers or talking heads on Sky Sports in England, or if it's just like a you know, some weird group of self-proclaimed masters on Twitter or whatever. But this new thing that's popped up this year about when you can and when you can't celebrate, and to what extent you should celebrate or shouldn't celebrate. Because, you know, obviously, after Arsenal won penalty kicks, the TV feed showed, you know, us celebrating a pretty good bit, doing the selfie thing again with the taking somebody's, you know, one of the photographers' on-field cameras, and I think it was Cazorla and Ramsey were, you know, doing the selfie thing again and just celebrating getting into the final, which then got turned into, why is Arsenal celebrating beating Wigan, a championship side that they shouldn't be celebrating? Is that how far this club's fallen? When all week long, you know, the whole thing was, well, even though they're the favorites, there's so much pressure on Arsenal, yada yada yada. And then, of course, with the FA moving the semifinals to Wembley now. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Wembley. We're told that Wembley, getting to Wembley is a big deal. So the logic should follow that if you win a match in Wembley, it's kind of a big deal. Like Ron Burgundy, of course. But apparently, because we're Arsenal and a bigger club than Wigan, we shouldn't be allowed to celebrate getting into the final or beating Wigan or whatever the hell was the reason that we weren't supposed to be celebrating yesterday, which, like I said, we caught flack last year for pipping Spurs to the fourth spot, you know, your arch rival. So, like I said, it was just kind of annoying yesterday that this, like I said, there's these new seemingly priests of the celebration out there that want to tell people when and where they can celebrate or what they can celebrate, which to me is ridiculous, because the day I learned to stop enjoying a victory, no matter how you get it, is the day I stopped watching sports, because after that, what's the freaking point?
Well, Arsenal's not allowed to have passion, because you don't have that core, that English steel. If you had more English steel, then you'd be allowed to, but you don't. So get some English steel, and then you could celebrate all you want.
We got five of them now, but like I said, that's what's...
I know, but they're finesse players, though. You don't have any...
True.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. You don't have the prototypical, you know, English midfield, put in a tackle, you know, knock someone to the ground.
Well, but you also bring up, and, you know, to tie it back to the original joke and intro about the passion, that's the other ridiculous thing, is that... Because one of the charges within the Arsenal fan fandom is that our players don't show enough passion at times, and then, you know, showing that, hey, we won, we're in the final, you know, let's enjoy the moment. Somehow you're not supposed to be able to show that passion because we're Arsenal. And again, I'm not saying it was the Arsenal fans yesterday that were doing that, but like I said, throughout the year. You know, there's always cries of, you know, they need to show more passion and fight for the shirt, and Wenger needs to show more emotion, blah, blah, blah. And then, like I said, when they do yesterday, all of a sudden the media wants to try and pull this crap about, oh, well, Arsenal shouldn't be celebrating over Wigan because it's just Wigan, even though you know, Manchester United basically gets their asses handed to them for all of 20 minutes, or all but 20 minutes over two legs against Bayern Munich, and somehow they had a brave, courageous fight and were unlucky, even though, like I said, they were by far the second better side in that tie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, for the sake of brevity, I have no comment on anything you said, so we can move on.
Yeah, so like I said, anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because I just think it's ridiculous because like I said, I don't understand why some people watch sports at that point when it's if you can't enjoy a victory no matter who it's against, you know? And especially a victory getting into the final in the historical stadium of Wembley, so.
All right, and speaking of Wembley, hey, there is another game today at Wembley. Imagine that.
Yeah, I thought you were going to talk about the second Fraggle on Fraggle Rock. But...
No. Okay. Oh, I forgot about that. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is very good.
Yeah, woo! Gobos. Yeah, Gobos, buddy.
Yeah. But today, and then the second FA Cup semifinal, and a very entertaining match.
It was a cracker, man.
Was Hull 5, Sheffield United 3, which was the highest scoring semifinal FA Cup match since 1958. And with the victory, Hull have reached their first major final in club history.
Yeah, which I kind of predicted yesterday because I don't know if you saw my tweet that if the Football Manager League Cup scheduling bug translates to real life, we'll be playing Hull.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So we'll talk about this match here, but first I would like to say Sheffield United aren't on TV very often because they're in League One, but we got to see a new member of the Sweet Beard Club.
Oh, dude, his beard was magnificent.
Brayford, right?
Yes.
Brayford.
As someone who wears a beard himself, I was definitely jealous. That dude's beard was awesome.
I don't know how to describe it. It looked kind of old school.
Yeah, it looked like a really good, like, Henry VIII, like, medieval beard. It was just, it was just awesome. Let's put it this way. If he was a landed lord, I would have pledged my fealty to him, just on his beard alone. It was magnificent.
And he had an assist. So he's not just a good-looking bloke.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, even in defeat, that was my man of the match, was that guy's beard.
So cheers to you, Sheffield United, and your awesome right back, Brayford, and his awesome beard. Let's have it a round of applause.
World class.
All right, so let's talk about this match. Now, Steve Bruce, a.k.a. Fat Leno, and I must say that I'm very sad to say that I saw no crowd shots of people wearing the Fat Leno masks.
Well, so they might have been banned just for the sake of, you know, the public good.
Yeah, maybe, because they are pretty freaky. They didn't want, like, no cult activity at Wembley. Sorry, folks.
Right.
You can't bring that. But Steve Bruce, he got his formation completely wrong to start the game. And they just didn't look like at all that they were in. They just looked like Hull City. We should say City for now because they are Hull City until their crazy Asian owner does otherwise. Hull City, sorry, I got off track again, is they look like they just thought they could just show up and just roll over Sheffield United. Would you agree with that assessment from what they look like in the first half?
Yes, but I will also add the caveat that I think they were, they being Hull, were kind of taken down a notch because Jelavic, however you say his name, and Long were cup tied. And they've obviously been their top strike force for the last couple months. So I think part of it had to do with that. But yeah, I do agree with. I kind of think they came out and you know, they read the blog and, you know, they saw themselves as EPL people or EPL players and said, you know, our opponents are League One, we're going to walk this. So.
Mm-hmm. And even before they conceded the
even
goal
with Yannick Sagbo or whatever.
Well, the Sagbo goal was the equalizer.
Yeah, I just meant that it pretty much came out of nothing. So even though they scored that, they were well outplayed.
Mm-hmm. So they were down 1-0. You had a former highly thought of player at Everton, Jose Baxter, scored in the 19th minute. And about the 40th minute or so on Twitter, I said, hey, if Hull has any chance to get back in this game and to win, Steve Bruce has no choice but to make two subs. Because Boyd was obviously checked out. I don't even know what the hell he was doing. Like, at the time, he wasn't even trying to even go after the ball. He wasn't tracking back at all.
Yeah, it definitely looked like Boyd was just, you know, the proverbial just happy to be there at Wembley and kind of
so
out for a stroll.
Mm-hmm, so I said, hey, Hull are going to be forced to make two changes at halftime to turn this around. And then they did score in the 44th minute. Actually, no, they scored in the 42nd, my bad. Tied the game up, but then they had the dreaded, not to bring up FM again, but the dreaded, you know, get nailed right back.
Right.
A minute later after you score. So they were down 2-1 at halftime, and they could have been 1-1. And so Steve Bruce hit the reset button, and he brought off Figueroa and Boyd and brought on two attackers, and Aluko and Fryat. So he did a brave thing, being a goal down at halftime. Basically, they went with three at the back for the last half of the game.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty interesting that they were saying that in overall season goals with Fryat's goal, he's Hull's leading goal scorer for the season despite not having started an EPL match.
I thought
that was pretty interesting.
And he only came to the club in the window, the winter transfer window.
Yeah, yeah.
So to make things even worse from Sheffield United, do you know where they got Fryat from?
Was it Wednesday?
Yes, Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah.
So Fryat is a Sheffield Wednesday player, and this is his stat line this year. It's quite incredible. He now has played 5 matches in the FA Cup and has 4 goals. In the Premier League, he's played 7 times for Hull City and has 7 matches, 1 goal. And in the Championship for Sheffield Wednesday, before he got transferred over, he had 9 matches with 4 goals. So he has a total of 5 goals for Hull, and you're telling me he's their leading scorer on the year?
That's what they said on the broadcast.
Holy mackerel.
Because I think their other leading scorer, or the second leading scorer, I guess, it's either Long or Jalovic, and they're another one that's only come in the window, or, you know, in the winter window.
Mm-hmm. So I know a lot of people are saying, and for good reason, that Tony Pulis should be coach of the year, but I really do believe that Steve Bruce should be ahead of him because Hull is safe; they're not going to get relegated. They're in the final now of a major cup competition. And there's not, I can't think of very many people who thought Hull were going to stay up at the beginning of the year. You and I both didn't think they'd make it. We both thought they'd be relegation fodder. But, you know, they don't play the most attacking football. But they're a direct team, but it's not long ballish, you know?
Yeah, no, it's definitely that more, like you said, it's a direct style, but it's definitely not a hoof it up there style. It's more of the kind of the traditional English direct style, just, you know, not the hoof it into the box and look for a knockdown kind of thing.
Not the Jose Mourinho score in 19th century football.
Yes, the Sam Allardyce special with extra cheese.
With extra cheese, the Royale.
Yes.
Cheese. The Royale Long Ball.
Yeah, oi, and throw a little more, throw a little bit of gravy on it too, love.
but I would agree
that Bruce should arguably be Coach of the Year, if nothing else, just because I don't want to give anything to Tony Pulis. So.
No, I don't know how the, and you may know, how do these things work in the English game? Can they take the cup competition in consideration for that? Or is that a league only?
I'm not sure, because I think there's two different ones. There's the PFA, which I think is generally league only.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there's the FA, which I think is any, or which is any or all competitions.
Okay. So maybe we'll get a split this year, and that'd be fair.
Yeah, because the PFA is the players organization, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
And then the FA is, you know, obviously the overall governing body. But yeah, I think the FA one, you can take into consideration any competition.
Mm-hmm. So we forgot to mention that Hull made the changes, Steve Bruce did, and then right away they paid off. They scored 4 minutes into the second half with Fryatt, who was one of the subs, and we just talked about him. Moments later, the slowest center back in the history of English football must be playing for Sheffield United because he got outran by Tom Huddlestone.
Yeah. Tom Hundredstone.
Yeah. And that was a nice finish by him. And then Stephen Quinn made it 4-2. Sheffield United made it interesting, scoring in stoppage time to make it 4-3, but then David Myler put the icing on the cake in stoppage time as well, making it 5-3.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't see the fourth goal because I had the replay of the fourth goal is actually what woke me up, because I had dozed off since I had gotten up at 4:30 to watch the Man City-Liverpool match. So I had kind of dozed off for that fourth goal. So I saw I saw Sheffield United get back into the match, and then obviously Hull had a textbook counterattack to put the ball or to put the game, you know, to put the game to bed.
Mm-hmm. And that was nice.
Yeah, no, it was definitely
calm and collected.
Yeah, and they did everything correctly on that counterattack. You know, they got the ball out quick. Their spacing was right. The timing of the passing was right, that last run, because Myler easily could have strayed offside, if he would have been impatient. But like I said, he timed his run to perfection. So like I said, they did everything textbook on that counter.
And the finish wasn't as easy as it looked too.
Yeah, no, because actually I thought he was going to square it, because the guy on the far side, who I forget who it was, it might have been Al-Mohammadi maybe, would have had an open net tap in. But yeah, like you said, Myler chose to go for it himself, and yeah, it was definitely a much more difficult chance than it looked. But you know, he finished it with, as the English would say, one of my favorite words that they use. He finished with aplomb.
Mm-hmm. So now May 16, if memory serves correct, is the magic date.
The final's the 17th, I thought.
Oh, is it the 17th? Okay. Well, sorry.
Yeah, 17. Open.
Okay, sorry, I was a day off. So May 17 is the final, which we will see at Wembley, of course, with Arsenal taking on Hull City.
Yeah.
Now, but to close the show, let's just talk about two general FA Cup things.
Okay.
And I guess since we're talking about Hull City and Sheffield United, let's bring this up first. Now, I was really disappointed with the scheduling on Sunday. Now, Saturday, the Arsenal-Wigan game was the last game of the day. There was no other top league, no Premier League action running concurrent with it. But for whatever reason, today, the Chelsea-Swansea match was at the same time as Hull and Sheffield United. So do you think that it's a little disrespectful to the FA Cup to have a Premier League match being played at the same time as an FA Cup semifinal?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because sometimes the Sunday match date, the match times, if I remember correctly, I think sometimes, especially for the traveling, you know, for people having to travel to London, I thought some of that has to do with like train time or in like travel time kind of stuff. But you know, obviously, with that said, that doesn't mean they can't move the match time for the league match. Yeah, so I guess my actual point is I'm not quite sure, because sometimes that scheduling has to do with weird, like, transportation issue things.
No, and that is right, and I forgot to think about that. That is true. That is a guideline that they do have when they make their schedule. And I'm trying to think what else came. TV could come into play there, because I don't know who owns the rights over there.
Yeah, the FA Cup, yeah, I want to say it's Sky, but I actually have no clue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're definitely the same feed. So they're probably on two different networks, and they both wanted it to have a prime time, or not a prime time slot, but a prime slot to show their matches. But it's still the Chelsea-Swansea match should have been played earlier. But they didn't want to overrun with the Man City-Liverpool match. I understand that as well.
Right.
So there's no easy answer to that question, but I think that's the problem. The English public and the media whine and complain about, oh, the FA Cup's not special anymore, and it's because it's not treated special anymore. That's part of the problem.
Yeah, no, and I agree, and that's, you know, obviously in other countries, their domestic cups aren't held in nearly as high regard as the FA Cup is, you know, partly to do with the FA Cup is the, you know, the oldest or one of the oldest, you know, professional sports competitions, or, you know, team sports competitions. But yeah, like you said, I think part of the reason why some people are losing interest in it is that it's kind of being diminished on two different fronts, you know, partly with the expansion of the Premier League, that a lot of people tend to tune in and put more credence or follow more closely the Champions League because of the perception of, you know, being the best in Europe, or, you know, going against Europe's best. And then on the second front, as you're saying, because of the way that their TV, you know, the viewing rights work over there, as opposed to here, where the league doesn't, you know, doesn't actually have any sort of control over that, or you know, they can only suggest things. That's part of the reason why some people are kind of losing interest in the FA Cup, which is a shame, because I think both games were really good advertisements of why, or at least in my opinion, why the FA Cup is such a good competition, because you know. To use another proverbial phrase, a lot of times those lower league teams, you know, going against higher teams, you can throw a lot of that stuff out of the window, especially when you get to this point of the competition when, you know, regardless of what league you're in, you make it to the semifinals of a competition that has, you know, that starts out with 700 clubs and that has, you know, 96 professional clubs starting out in it, you know, in the FA Cup proper. That, like I said, by the time you get to this stage of the competition, you know, you're not just some talentless hack. You know, you've had to beat some pretty good teams to get here.
Mm-hmm. And then let's move on.
Okay.
To our final topic related to the FA Cup. So now, for a few seasons now, we've had the format change to where Wembley has hosted the semifinals. So now that we've seen this a few times, is it a yay or nay? Do you like the semifinal being moved to Wembley as opposed to the traditional, you know, draw at one of the participants' home sites?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of neutral on that, but that's neutral coming from a place where I used to be opposed to it. I do think that it was part of the thing that added to the atmosphere of today's match. So I think in the future, it's probably a good thing, especially, you know, if you get more sides that are going to be like a Sheffield United that's, you know, in the third tier of the league system. Obviously today was a really big deal for them, and you could tell
a day out. Yeah,
exactly. It's the day out, and that even though I think you'd be hard pressed to find Sheffield United fans that legitimately thought they were going to win, other than, you know, the odd stroke of luck. But at the same time, it's the day vacation thing that, you know, even if you don't win, you get to go to London, you get to see the big city or whatever you want to, you know, whatever little analogy you want to use, and you get to have the day out and maybe see something memorable. And if not, you know, it's still a day that you can kind of build memories, and especially if you have kids kind of thing, that's the kind of thing that, you know, it's going to build that foundation with younger fans that, besides the league, there's these kind of chances to dream for a small club, you know, to make a name for themselves, even if it's only for a day. So, like I said, I'm kind of neutral on it. I'm neither for it or against it, but I'm neutral on it. Like I said, coming from a place where I used to be definitely against it. So, I guess overall, it's a good thing.
No, it's a blatant money grab.
Well, there's that too.
On the hands of the FA.
There is that.
But from a sporting standpoint, I kind of do like it now. I was against it, and now I'm kind of neutral. From the sporting standpoint, I think it's good for the berth in a final of the FA Cup is a big thing. And so it to be played on a neutral, in quotes, pitch, I think is a good way to decide things. And plus, yes, if we're going to see less of the Premier League teams putting emphasis on the FA Cup for Champions League glory, I think you're going to see a lot of these, you know, second and third division sides in the Championship and League One and what have you make it to these semifinals. And so it's a big deal for them to be able to come play in Wembley.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, because it's a semifinal, obviously the tickets are going to be pretty pricey, and, you know, some of those smaller clubs might have to incur more travel cost and stuff to get there. But at the same time, I think it's one of those where, in this case, I think it would be a situation where a lot of those clubs would think it's money well spent just because of the prestige and, you know, the experience that it gives the fans.
Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong. Now, I didn't look up the official numbers, but just from looking on TV, it seemed to me that the whole Sheffield United game, the stadium was much fuller than it was for Arsenal Wigan.
No, I thought it was the other way around because I thought in the first half I saw a pretty good bit of empty seats in the lower section.
Okay, and it could be, you know, strategic camera work to make things look the way they want them to look. But I saw a lot of empty seats in Arsenal Wigan, and I didn't see them today. So yeah, that'll be something I'll have to check out on my own later.
Yeah, because somebody tweeted earlier, and again, it was one of those, I didn't check the numbers, but it made sense. Now, again, these were just tickets sold, too, so that's another thing you got to take into consideration. But according to the numbers, this girl tweeted that Arsenal had bought, I think, 53,000 tickets. I believe Sheffield was second with, or not Sheffield, sorry, Hull was second with 33,000. Sheffield, I think, had 25,000, and Wigan had like 13 or 14,000 or something.
Okay.
But you know, that was the club tickets. That wasn't the
neutrals.
Right. So I'm not sure exactly how many neutrals were on offer for each match.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that could have been part of that Arsenal ticket count. Might have been Arsenal fans buying neutral tickets too.
That's possible.
But yes. So like I said, to be honest, I'm not really sure. But from what I saw yesterday, it looked like the stadium was pretty full for Arsenal Wigan.
Okay, maybe I was drunk. It looked like empty seats to me, like lots of them, but hey, that's just me.
Yeah, I was going to say, according to a few people on my Twitter feed that I'm Arsenal buddies with, according to them, the stadium was shaken when Wigan was taking penalties, shaken with Arsenal fans booing, and then, it was loud with encouragement when Arsenal was shooting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
All right, and I will.
Because, again, it's Twitter, so you never really know.
Twitter is always right.
Yes.
Except when it's wrong.
Well, I was going to say, Twitter's right even more so when it's wrong.
but you know what is good about Twitter, regardless of they're right or wrong?
No, please tell me.
They have passion.
Oh, absolutely.
There's always passion on Twitter.
Oh,
people
that
are very
that
passionate very... about their views and their opinions.
Yes.
So, all right, folks, this has been the Two Daft Yanks FA Cup semi-final review podcast. We hope you have enjoyed our passionate talk about this lovely competition. And I cannot wait until the final in May. And I urge you all to, just to piss off Corey, to pledge your allegiance to Hull City.
Yeah, if wanting Arsenal Schadenfreude, if that's what floats your boat, as long as you tune in, just do it. Just watch the game, though.
Yes, I will be tuning in solely for the Arsenal Schadenfreude, but I know that they're clear favorites, but I can still dream and hope.
Yeah, because, again, maybe the final is when they're going to spring the stadium full of fat Leno masks.
Yes, to truly terrify people.
Oh, Leno! Leno Bruce has gone with a tactical surprise and gone with the creepy Leno mask stadium ploy.
Oh, boy. All right, folks, we will be back with you next week, and we will be full on to the Prem again, and we'll see what twists and turns come our way when we see you this time next week. So, for Corey Chatelain, I am Chad Smith. We will see you later.
Stevie G has passion!
This has been the Two Daft Yanks podcast. If you like the show, be sure to find the Yanks at twodaftyanks.com or at @twodaftyanks on Twitter. There, you can stay up to date on all the Two Daft Yanks action by subscribing to the show.